This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 92-year-old Larry Cosgrove of Signal Hill, California. He signed up for the Army Specialized Training Program during World War II, providing the opportunity to get a college education in the military. So what was your expectation, Larry?
Well, we knew we were headed for Fort Benning, Georgia and the infantry school, but that was for basic training.
So you're supposed to do that and then go to then a college campus for classes. How'd you feel about what they did to you,
Fort Benning? It was exactly the same as the paratroopers were there, but they did push-ups when we had to, and they ran when we had to hike. But it was a basic infantry program. I have a grandson that's in the Air Force, and he went through basic. We went back to see him graduate, and they showed us films of his training, and it looked about the same. Doing the same kind of things that we did with the rifle training and the marching and the big packs and all that.
Was it a challenge for you or a piece of cake?
Oh, no, it was a challenge. They put us through some pretty strenuous efforts. We'd been working, you know, always on the farm and riding our bicycles and walking, so physically I was up to it, but it was a challenge. And then just going from a relaxed issue at home, if I didn't make my bed, my mother wouldn't get too excited. But the sergeant would.
His language was probably a little different from your mother's, too.
Yes, quite a bit. And so that, you know, for all of us, we're all, I think everybody in that unit was probably 18. You know, we were still kids. Now we've got to learn to be a man. So it was rough. They didn't coddle us. They were demanding. And I remember the drill sergeant we had that right as we were getting ready to finish the 3 months, he says, "I know all of you hate me," he says, "but you may realize someday that some of the things I taught you might have saved your life." And that's probably true.
I bet it was a relief to be done with that and get to a college campus to study.
Then we shipped off to the college campus, and of course the discipline was much relaxed.
And you figured, I'll be here for a couple of years studying, just like a college kid.
That's kind of what we were looking forward to. That's why we adopted our theme song was, "Take down your service flag, mother, your son's in the ASTP."
Little did you know. So tell us what happened to change all that.
Well, in 3 months, they canceled the program. They figured that it would take too long to get us to be performing engineers, and they needed manpower elsewhere. And
they were about to launch the invasion of Europe.
Well,
they
still a ways off, but we were then shipped down to Camp Campbell. It's a fort now, but then it was a camp, and most of the fellows went into the 14th Armored Infantry, and for some reason I was put into a ordnance company. Did a bit of training and then overseas to England.
And some people may have an idea of what that means, but maybe you can give us a better picture. I know you can. What that unit existed for, the 467th Ordnance Evacuation Company.
Well, our main purpose was to find tanks on the battlefield that had been disabled but were not totally destroyed, and where the crews were still alive. And then we would bring a new tank up to them, to the front. Then we would pick up the old one, put it on our trailer, and take it back to the rear echelon to some maintenance unit who would repair it and put it back into service. And that was our basic assignment. Go out and find the tanks. We had recon crews, and then we had teams that took the tank transports and took a tank up to the front, and then were scheduled to bring back the tanks. But Patton was moving so fast that they gave that up, and they said, "Forget about the damaged tanks, just leave them. Turn around, go back and get another tank and bring it up." So that was pretty much what we did, what the company did. Now, I was a driver on one of the transports for a while, but I had other, for a while, driving a 10-ton wrecker when these things needed repairs. You had to have a pretty big unit for that. Drove a lot of Jeeps, a lot of 2.5-ton trucks, had a 3/4-ton Dodge weapons carrier for a while. We were trained in all of the motor vehicles.
And this is an element of the war in Europe that probably a lot of people have never even considered, that there would be someone with the job that you had. And I don't want to presume anything, but when you think back to that time at Camp Campbell, where just about everybody is funneled into this 14th Armored Infantry, and you go elsewhere to this ordnance company. Would you say that was, in theory, a safer job than you would have had if you'd gone with everybody else?
Much, much so. We were in harm's way sometime, but not, you know, infantry, you're always in harm's way. And so we had areas and times that we were in danger, but for the most part, it was just a lot of hard work and a lot of very boring driving on those French and Belgian and Holland roads where they were narrow, and we had big units. And
big, slow units.
So yes. Yeah, they didn't go very well. You couldn't. They didn't have the highways to even do it.
Sure.
If you had a freeway system.
Well, I'm sure you saw a lot of things, and I'm interested in all those things you saw. But just on this topic of that fateful turn of not going with that infantry unit, but going with this ordnance company instead. I've talked to a lot of guys that have had a moment like that where, you know, their buddies went here, they stayed there, and it wouldn't be till after the war they realized, well, what happened to the guys who went over there? But I bet for you, because of your job, you're probably getting a taste of at least the kinds of things that those guys are going through because you're delivering these tanks to where they are.
Yeah.
So that was probably with you the whole war, the perspective of, I could be doing what those guys are doing.
Yes.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, I'm not sure there was a feel. There were times when I'd read about the things that were going on. We did get some news there, and just saying, I trained for that, but thank God I'm not doing it right now.
Mm.
But later I was called, because I had the infantry training, they were needing more bodies at the front, so they pulled us out, gave us a brief retraining, but before that ended, the Germans surrendered, so I didn't actually serve as an infantry rifleman.
And I don't think you're complaining about that.
Not a bit.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can give us a sense of some of the things you saw, because you were over there for quite a long time. You got to England in, what, spring of 44?
Probably May of 44. Yeah, that would be spring.
You went across, and you were there till the Germans surrendered in May of 45.
Yes.
Right? But you must have seen a few things through that stretch.
While we were in England, we were just marshaling vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
For everybody that was getting ready for the invasion and even after the invasion. We'd load into a 2.5-ton truck, maybe 20 guys, and drive to one of the ports. And then we'd take whatever vehicles were there. I mean, this was all planned. We did what we were told. Okay, get into all those Jeeps, and you're driving them back to the depot. And the company had a maintenance depot to prepare them all. They painted the unit designations on the bumpers and whatever had to be done, make sure they're all working, and then the companies were getting ready to go into France would come get their vehicles and take them. And so most of that time I was on the road, and we had a convoy commander, and you just got in your line and followed the truck ahead of you. Then we were packed up and headed off for France.
In your time in England, did you witness or get a feel for some of the damage that had been inflicted on England?
We didn't get to any of the cities that took a lot of damage, but mm-hmm. we did see some, and we talked to people that were in some of the areas, one where the company was billeted in a building and a buzz bomb hit it, one of the V1s,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of those that didn't have a direction. They just flew until they ran out of fuel, and then they crashed,
mm-hmm.
and the Germans were hoping they'd hit something important, but they were really more for demoralizing.
Yeah.
Scaring people.
Well, I'd be scared if I don't know when something's going to fall out of the sky and blow me up.
And you'd hear them pop, pop, you know, we didn't have any come near us. But we were really out in the country, and there were no military targets there. We were in a woods that was camouflaged. I mean, the trees covered a lot. We had a lot of vehicles in there, but they were, at least they told us, they were pretty much invisible from the sky. We did have a number of accidents. I had a fella go to sleep at the wheel ahead of me. We were on the now in American left-wheel drive cars on English roads on the left, driving on the left side. And every once in a while, somebody would forget or just be startled by something and, you know, try to get back where they thought they should be mentally from learning to drive here.
Sure.
And so one time a guy just went to sleep, and he was just in a Jeep. We were taking Jeeps that time, and he was ahead of me. Suddenly he just swerved, went all across the other side and off into a tree, and no seat belts. There's a windshield wiper unit up, and he just jammed his face in it. His whole eye was, we got all parked and jumped out and ran over there. The sergeant that was in charge of the convoy, he says, well, we can't do anything for him. Somebody will get him help, so get back in your Dick was get going. You know, so we all got back, and we never saw him again. He never came. I don't know whether he lived or died or what. Then we had one time we came back from our trip, and there was one rig that went out at the same time. But we all worked independently. We didn't go in convoys in France. We started suddenly realizing, hey, you know, where's Charlie? Then later found out that these things had a big gas tank on them because we had to go a long distance and they use a lot of gas and they didn't want to have to provision gas. So they put a big gas tank on up above the fifth wheel. And nobody knows whether they got hit by a German unit that when they got up close to the front or whether an accident happened or the tank split. But they, when they found them, the tank had split and the whole rig had burned and all three bodies were just charred. And we had our first sergeant and our motor sergeant and our mess sergeant, right after we got into France, had decided they wanted to see what the front was like. And so they took a Jeep and they went someplace and they got hit. Might have hit a road mine. Nobody knew, but because they wouldn't tell the rank what happened.
But all three of them were killed.
Yeah.
That was right after you got to France.
That was early in our arrival at France.
But what does that do to you when you're over there, 19 years old, and guys that are doing the same thing that you're going to be doing just got killed?
Yeah. Well, it's on your mind. It's not something you just dismiss and don't worry about. But we're riding down the highway. If you're driving one of those big rigs, you've got to keep all your concentration on driving. And you've got to, either the sergeant or the alternate driver would be in the passenger on the opposite side, watching that side of the road. So our minds were pretty well kept on what we were doing. And usually at night, we'd park someplace and try to stay warm. So we didn't really dwell on that. We knew that's a possibility. We knew when we got on that boat in New York, we'd already read of how many of the ships had been sunk by the Wolfpack.
Sure, those U-boats in the Atlantic.
And we were in a pretty big convoy, and we had they'd turn all the time. So you'd be up on deck during the day, and you'd see these ships. There's a destroyer, and here's a destroyer. And every once in a while, you'd hear those whoop, 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 whoop. When they'd hit their sirens, they had some kind of a warning of something. And wow, and you see the destroyer go off in a different direction. But we made it over without any problems. There was no ships in our convoy were damaged, to my knowledge. So, it's in your mind. I just never really had a great worry. I knew there was a possibility, but it wasn't like being in the front lines or where the artillery shells were coming in or where a sniper might be up there in a tree someplace or anything. We didn't have that kind of an atmosphere. But we worried more about would it be out in the boonies and the truck break down. You know, then what would we do? We didn't have radios. We didn't have cell phones or anything like that.
Yeah.
We'd have to find some way to get to some village where they could connect with some army communication unit and let people know what we needed. I don't want to say I was ever really worried about it. We all knew we were exposed because they were still getting reports of a truck going down some side road and hitting a mine.
Sure.
They tried to clear them all as best they... They've still got mines over there that they haven't found.
Exactly.
Because the Germans, as they retreated, they ceded the ground.
So you have the possibility of mines. I'm sure there were some times that you were in areas where enemy artillery fire was at least a possibility. German planes could be in the area. And if they see a big, slow truck with a tank on the bed, I mean, that's an easy target, right? Am I on track here? Those some potential hazards you faced?
Those were certainly hazards. And the original plan... Our unit had a 50 caliber machine gun on the cab. So one of us was designated as the driver and the other as the gunner, and we were interchangeable, and we had the buck sergeant was our commander. But right after we got over there, they took the 50s away and said, you don't need them. We're not forecasting any Luftwaffe resistance here. And there wasn't really, because they were using all the planes to try to stop the bombers.
Well, you just handed me a picture of a truck.
That's an M25 tank transport.
So you were driving this big monster very slowly, apparently on some snowy roads, because I'm looking at the backdrop. There's a lot of snow.
At that time the picture was taken, because northern France and Belgium and Holland, that was through the cold winter. and there was snow.
And how did you guys deal with that snow and what, you know, it was famously the worst winter they'd have in decades?
We just did the best we could. While we're in a truck like this, we didn't have a heater system, but that engine put off so much heat, it was warm inside the cab. But at night, when the engine's off, we had sleeping bags and a couple extra blankets.
Inside the truck?
Then we slept in the truck.
Yeah.
And we'd wake up in the morning and look out for smoke coming out of a chimney, because that was a bakery.
Ah.
In those little French towns and Belgian towns, the baker was always the first one up.
Uh-huh.
And we'd go and trade a few packets of Nescafe for a big loaf of warm French bread.
Mm.
And we'd get from the mess hall, we'd get a big number can of marmalade or strawberry jam. And instead of using the rations we got for breakfast, which weren't something to write home about. But warm French bread with marmalade in the morning is kind of a nice start. And then we were off again.
Well, and so wintertime, most of American forces in Europe, in one way or another, were involved in what was happening in the Battle of the Bulge, whether you were there or on the perimeter of it. So where were you during that period from mid-December through the end of January, and what were you doing?
Well, we had driven up to Maastricht, Holland. I think then I was driving a 2.5-ton, and we were taking other kind of supplies. They utilized whatever they had for supplying the front lines. And we unloaded, and the big rig was staying back, and because I could go faster than a 2.5. So we're just two of us. And we were heading back down the highway, and we came to a roadblock, MPs.
Mm-hmm.
And they stopped us and said, what's wrong? They said, well, you can't go through. The Germans have broken through. And so we parked our units, and then the big unit came in, and we had to wait there with, we all had weapons. They didn't keep the 50 caliber, but I had an 03, 1903 model Springfield.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because we're not combat troops, we don't need the
you
fast
don't need the
automatic.
M1. Yeah.
Yeah, the M1s. And I think the sergeant had a carbine, or I forgot what the other fella had. So we had to get out, and we just stayed there. And they did have some units coming. We were on that, as the bulge went in here, we were about on this side, on the Holland side,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to Belgium. And we waited that out, and we never got into any fighting there, but we had to be ready.
You're ready to take them on with
your
Springfield
rifle. And it was plenty
rifle.
Cold. Now, that's... I got a bit of frostbite in my feet that I still suffer with, but it wasn't debilitating. It just, I thought I was okay, but as I've gotten older, my feet have caused me some problems from that. But
what kind of challenges do you deal with there? Is it just neuropathy, or
you don't
feel stuff? Or
no. Well, they get the tingling where I can't sleep.
Can't sleep because the nerves are on fire.
Yeah, they just got to move. You can't.
Yeah.
I'm doing it right now, just thinking about it, moving my toes.
Well, and I only ask because you're not alone. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of American servicemen over there who suffered frostbite, some worse than others, some to a debilitating point.
Oh, yeah.
My grandfather, who was in the medical corps there during that time, said he treated more frozen feet than anything else.
Yeah,
and there wasn't a whole lot you guys could do about it.
Now, see, when we were there, we weren't dressed like the people who were supposed to be there. We weren't supposed to be.
You were supposed to get in and get out.
We were supposed to be riding along in a truck.
Yeah.
And we had heavy Mackinaws, we had long underwear, tops and pants, and had combat boots, but we didn't have those big galoshes, heavy for slops, you know, sloshing along in the snow. So it was a little uncomfortable, but not as uncomfortable as a lot of guys had in the bulge.
Sure. That sounds kind of nerve-wracking, though, because you guys probably didn't know how long you were going to be stuck there.
No. Nobody knew anything. Because there's no communication.
Sure.
And we didn't know whether the Germans were going to break through in there. Then finally it came, but that wasn't probably till, it was after Christmas, but before New Year's, before they had pushed them back and they'd reopened the roads so that all the units could pass on through.
Was that kind of a nerve-wracking time for you?
Well, it's any time you don't know what's happening and you know bad things could happen. Yes, it keeps your mind... It takes a while. I did have a little Bible reading book with me, and I read that a lot.
Hmm.
Personally given to me by Franklin Roosevelt. Well, he didn't personally give it to me, but he signed it.
He signed it.
Well, he signed the page that was printed.
I'm just trying to imagine being in that situation, especially when you talk about what you're armed with. I mean, if you've got a Springfield rifle, that's basically, hey, here's a weapon we don't think you're ever going to need, but just in case, at least you look like you're doing something. Right?
I mean, yeah, yes.
Was there a point where you thought, I might have to use this? And, you know, we could be
kind of...
Well,
we were prepared. If it came to that, we had to. You never know what's going to happen.
What do you think would have happened if there were some German tanks in the area?
I'm sure if somebody in a Tiger tank saw that unit, they'd want to knock it out.
Yeah.
Certainly. And ground troops, without being in a defensive mode, probably wouldn't worry them that much. But I would... A lot of Americans were taken prisoner.
Sure.
There were a lot of American prisoners because they just were overwhelmed and had no chance to fight back.
Especially during that time period.
Yeah, during the Bulge. So the dangers were there, and just grace of God, I made through.
He did, and he's still going strong at 92. I'm going to let you hear him sing a little when we come back. Check out the photos of today's guest, Larry Cosgrove, at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.